We'll call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. Quorum is present, and the first order of business would be to consider the minutes from the meeting of March 7th. Representative Knuth, we would appreciate a motion to approve the minutes. We have a motion to approve the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are approved. First item on the agenda, Representative Johnson, House File 1549.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1549.
I think this can be sent from this committee to the General Register, Representative Johnson, and as far as I'm aware. Is that correct?
That's correct. It could probably even go to the consent calendar if that was satisfactory.
We'll see how the testimony goes. If Mr. Hart doesn't get beat up too bad, we'll consider that.
Very good, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, Burl Haar. My name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. I sense the pressure is on now. So. The commissioners at the Public Utilities Commission are subject to restrictions on ex parte communications. The intent is to prohibit communications between commissioners and parties concerning material issues in disputed cases before the commission. The statutes and rules that have been developed over the years to implement this prohibition are geared for communications between commissioners and parties. Parties are the relevant entity here because they're the organization, entities, individuals that have rights at stake in matters before the commission. They're the ones that have a dog in the fight, basically. Several sessions ago, provisions were added to the statutes to clarify how complaints on ex parte communications are to be handled, and it was an improvement in the statute. Unfortunately, the language that was put in used the term participant instead of party. And House File 1549 would change the participant to party. And the reason for it is that participant has a specific definition and rule, and it basically encompasses a much broader group of entities. It's basically interested parties, people who are simply interested in monitoring what's going on with a particular docket at the commission. They can become a participant. They don't really have any rights at stake. They're usually just monitoring or may come forward and express an opinion on it at a public hearing, but they really aren't a party active in the case. And what this does, the current language is basically creates confusion. Because all of the other provisions in statute and rules are geared towards parties. And the changes here would simply, hopefully, eliminate that confusion and make it consistent, make the language consistent.
Are there any questions? Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Haar, this means that if somebody wanted to relate what happens in a PUC meeting about a specific issue, that person can relate what they perceive happens in a meeting. However, nothing pertaining to what a commissioner says can be related in that communication. Is that correct?
Mr. Haar.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure when you say related, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that.
Representative Gunther?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's say that somebody is reporting on the proceeds of a meeting.
Yes.
If a person as a third party reported it, it would be perfectly fine. But if a commissioner reported, he would be violating his ex parte.
Mr. Chair,
Representative, The ex parte communications mainly applies to communications between commissioners and parties. Discussion, basically the intent is to not allow them to talk about material issues in cases that are active before the commission. If you're talking about comments that are made after a decision is made, is that the thrust of your question?
Mr. Chairman, or
Representative Gunther,
communications about what was done during that hearing or communications by a third party. Let's say a newspaper reporter who attended your meeting.
Right.
Where the commissioners and the participants cannot talk about it. That newspaper reporter could explain what happened.
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Chair. Absolutely, that's correct. I'm sorry.
Okay. Further questions? Seeing none, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 1549 be recommended to pass. Oh, excuse me. I should have asked if anyone wanted to testify on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paula McAfee, and I just wanted to ask a couple questions because I have been involved in PUC proceedings, both representing parties and participants. And I'm not sure I understand. Right now, I would understand that whether my client was a party or was a participant, my clients and I couldn't go and talk to a commissioner outside a public setting and, let's say, lobby them to make a difference. In the recent hearings that I concluded, I was representing both party and several participants in connection with the Minnesota Pipeline Company. And as a matter of fact, my client, the Gardens of Eden, was the only party other than the company, but there were literally dozens of landowners who were participants, and some of them had lawyers, and they were extremely much involved, and they cared very passionately about the effect of that proceeding. And as I read this, in my capacity representing two of the landowners, I could now go to one of the commissioners and plead their case because they weren't parties, even though they're interested in the proceeding. And I'm not sure that's what the intent of the author is, but I wanted that clarification. And I'm also looking forward to the CapEx 2020, which is a consortium of about 11 utilities, but it's likely there will be one lead applicant, probably Xcel Energy, maybe GRE. And as I understand it, this might mean that the other utilities who are very much interested financially in the proceeding could go and talk individually to commissioners without it being considered ex parte. And I would hope that that's not the intent of this amendment. And if it is, maybe there needs to be a little bit more clarification. So that's my comment, sir.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Haar, would you care to clarify that?
Well, excuse me, Mr. Chair and representatives. If individuals are represented by an attorney, presumably they have party status, and that's the intent. I guess we would probably not object to including participant and party, but it needs to, we feel it needs to be clear in the relevant section of the statute here that party be mentioned, because the current language is silent on party, and that is inconsistent with other sections of the statute. So, you know, that would potentially be a change we would accept, but we believe that party has to be mentioned in this part of the statute, just to avoid confusion, because presently it's confusing the way it is.
Well, Mr. Haar, that being the case, would Ms. McAbee's concerns be addressed then if we just said, instead of striking participant on line 11, say, and a participant or a party?
That would be acceptable, yes.
Ms. McAbee, would that allay your concerns?
Mr. Chair, it would, and I think it would provide some very helpful clarification.
before we tried to deal with that, Representative Magnus, you had a
Mr. Chairman, I didn't get the testifier's name and who she represents. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Mr. Chair, I said my name is Paula Maccabee, and I'm actually here not representing any individual client, but I'm reflecting my experience having represented several. So I'm sorry for that lack of clarity.
Representative Johnson, would you want to entertain that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would entertain that amendment.
So, Mr. Eloff, that would be, yeah, that
it language. Sounds, Mr. Chair, it sounds like the agreement is, well, to read the line 111, or indirectly, between a commissioner and a participant or a party under the commissions.
Satisfactory, Mr. Harr?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
The chair will move that amendment, or Representative Johnson, why don't you move that amendment?
Yes, I'll move that amendment as stated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor of the amendment as described, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Is further discussion to the bill? Anyone else care to testify? In that case, Representative Johnson would renew his motion to that House File 1549 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Oh, pardon me, yes, pass as amended, placed on the General Register. Still want to shoot for the consent calendar, Representative Johnson.
Well, that's satisfactory.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. And Representative Johnson, House File 1678.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1678 be recommended to pass as well and be placed on the General Register. And similar to the last piece of legislation, I'm going to let Mr. Harr speak to it. Essentially, what the bill does authorizes utilities to electronically file with the PUC, as well as some other technical changes, but he'll add the nuances.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Harr. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Minnesota laws of 2005, Chapter 97, included a provision requiring, actually a provision sponsored and authored by Representative Johnson, I might add, that required the PUC to establish a system allowing for submission and retrieval of documents over the Internet. The PUC and the Department of Commerce subsequently initiated a joint effort spearheaded by Catherine Hennessy, who is here today, to establish such a system. I'm happy to report that system has been implemented and has been up and running since the summer of 2006. However, the current language is still geared for the old paper-based system. And House File 1678 would simply update the language to allow electronic filing. It doesn't prohibit the continued use of a paper system because there are still organizations and individuals that need to use that, and we wouldn't want to affect that in any way. But it simply allows for electronic filing to occur. Specifically, it would allow electronic service of documents to and among parties, including commission-issued documents like notices and orders. The current language requires that be done by paper. The language changes would simply allow that to be done electronically where those parties are willing and able to accept it that way. The language changes would substantially enhance the functionality of the electronic filing system that's being used by the Commission, by the Department, and Office of Administrative Hearings, as well as our stakeholders. I should mention that this is really a joint proposal from the Commission, Department of Commerce, and the Office of Administrative Hearings. And Michael Lewis, who's an attorney with the Office of Administrative Hearings, is also here today. If you'd like, I could go through the various sections of the bill, but basically the language allows for electronic service and electronic filing.
Mr. Haar, how far-reaching is this? What are we permitting to be transacted in this way?
Mr. Chair, it allows companies and individuals to, rather than having to send over boxes and boxes of documents when they make filings, to send it via internet to submit it. It's officially accepted as an official filing. It cuts the costs substantially for the companies and individuals that are participating in our proceedings, because they don't have to reproduce everything with paper. Plus, they can access the documents over the internet. They don't have to go and get hard copies. They can pull them up on their screen. So it's a tremendous efficiency gain for, we believe, for certainly for us, and we believe for our stakeholders. It does not affect any of the basic processes of the commission anyway. I mean, the rules and the requirements are still in place. Due process is preserved. This simply allows some of that to be done electronically where parties are able to do it that way.
So, Mr. Haar, would is this all public information that would be available on the internet then?
Mr. Chairman, some of the information that companies provide as part of our proceedings sometimes is deemed to be trade secret. There are provisions or mechanisms in place to protect that information, just as we would if it was submitted in hard form. So we're still responsible for enforcing the Data Practices Act, and we have established safeguards to do that. But everything else is public. Yes.
In current practice, are the filings that are made the old-fashioned way made available on the internet as well?
Mr. Chair, yes, they are. We have a number of years ago, the Commission and the Department established a scanning system that allows hard copies to be scanned in and then made available on the via the internet. That is a more labor-intensive process because someone has to actually take the copy, make sure it's fit for scanning, mark it, submit it, get it in the system, and there's a bit of a delay in doing that. It just takes human power to do that. Electronic filing bypasses virtually all of it. It's much more efficient.
Well, we won't broach the question of a positive fiscal note on this bill, Representative Johnson. Are there any questions for Representative Johnson or Mr. Haar? Seeing none, Representative Johnson.
I would like to renew my motion then, Mr. Chair, that this matter pass and be sent to the General Register.
Representative Johnson moves that House File 1678 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Representative Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
Not really. Yeah. Well, Gunther has to leave. Representative Johnson, could you take the gavel so I can present the bill? We were hoping that we would be able to deal with House File 1214 next, but Representative Knuth's testifier is not here yet, so we will take testimony on House File 1392, which is my bill.
All right, well, welcome, Representative Hilty. Chair Hilty, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. What we ask is that House File 1392 would want to take testimony on that bill today and lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Very good.
With me, I have Mr. Rolf Nordstrom, who is the proponent of the bill, and will describe the bill for us.
Welcome, Mr. Nordstrom. If you would be willing to state again what your name is, who you represent, and proceed to testimony.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rolf Nordstrom. I serve as director of the Upper Midwest Hydrogen Initiative, which is a public-private coalition managed by the nonprofit Great Plains Institute in Minneapolis. Mr. Chair, distinguished members, I'm really grateful for the opportunity to talk to you today about the importance of passing House File 1392, the Renewable Hydrogen Development Act. I'm also pleased to report that the bill has already passed out of one Senate committee just earlier this week, passed out of the Energy Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee, and of course, we're hoping that you'll find it equally appealing and compelling in this body. As you see in the handout that I hope you all have, our coalition includes a number of Minnesota members that will be familiar to you, companies like 3M and Xcel Energy and Toro and University of Minnesota and others. I'd like to really start by thanking Representative Hilty and the other nine co-authors on this bill, on this committee, for their vision in seeing that any comprehensive energy strategy needs to have a mid- and long-term component. And this bill would add just such a component to Minnesota's energy policy by adding renewable, pollution-free hydrogen to the state's homegrown energy portfolio, right alongside sustainably produced biofuels and electricity. Growing concerns over energy security and future economic prosperity in air pollution and climate change have led companies and governments around the world to invest literally billions of dollars in energy systems in which electricity and hydrogen would be two of the main ways of storing and moving energy. And if hydrogen and fuel cells still seem a little like something out of the Jetsons to folks, consider the following. There are at least 15 countries that have invested heavily in having hydrogen and fuel cells be a part of their energy strategy. 37 states, including the District of Columbia, have some level of hydrogen fuel cell activity going on in their states, either tax incentives or incentives for early deployments of the technology. Indeed, North Dakota, the House of Representatives in North Dakota, has just passed a bill similar to the one that's before you today a couple of weeks ago in hopes of collaborating on a hydrogen transit bus project in Fargo-Moorhead, a project that both of those cities are committed to. In addition, this may be something of a shock, but there are, believe it or not, 72 hydrogen refueling stations in North America already, either operating or underway, probably 50 of those just in the U.S. And that number is more like over 250 hydrogen stations if you look worldwide. There's something like, in fact, just California alone has 26 hydrogen refueling stations with plans for 250 by 2015 and 20,000 hydrogen vehicles on the road, they hope, by 2015. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 to 500 hydrogen vehicles plying the roads around the world, and thousands of fuel cells have been installed over the last couple of decades. And this year, General Motors, for all their challenges, is planning to roll out 100 fuel cell vehicles in New York, California, and Washington, D.C., where there is some hydrogen refueling infrastructure already in place. And the reason for what they call the largest road test of hydrogen fuel cell vehicles is to prepare for mass introduction of fuel cell vehicles in 2011, which is not very far away, I think we could all agree. Both Honda and BMW have also announced plans to go to limited production around the end of the decade. And while the popular press has devoted much attention to fuel cell use in vehicles, passenger vehicles, there are actually a whole bunch of applications that are really ready or close to being commercially ready right now. Things like forklifts in large materials handling facilities, or ice refinishers, believe it or not. You know them as a Zamboni, although the one that is ready is not made by that company. Airport vehicles, shuttle buses, fuel cells for emergency and backup power at telecommunications sites, and groundskeeping equipment. Again, this may come as some surprise, but Minnesota-based Toro Company is just now finishing building its first four hydrogen fuel cell powered groundskeeping vehicles. One is a greens mower that you'd use, say, at a golf course, and the other is a small utility truck. And unfortunately, they won't be deploying those here in Minnesota, but instead in the state of New York as part of a $21 million hydrogen and fuel cell deployment project that the state of New York has going, using electricity at Niagara Falls to electrolyze hydrogen from water. Of course, we'd love to see Toro deploy those vehicles here. Why not maintain the greens at the University of Minnesota's golf course with those hydrogen fuel cell greens mowers, or any number of other high-visibility locations in Minnesota, for that matter? So, why hydrogen? Many people believe that hydrogen represents sort of the logical conclusion of an energy evolution that humans have been on, going from fuels like wood and coal that have a lot of carbon content, to hydrogen, which has no carbon at all. So many see hydrogen as sort of the logical destination in this evolutionary path, particularly in a world that's increasingly concerned about CO2 emissions from conventional fossil fuels. Although it's abundant, it's usually bound up with something else. So you need some other primary form of energy to get hydrogen from either water or from biomass. Luckily, Minnesota has lots of both. So maybe the way to think about hydrogen is as a medium of exchange, a way to store and move energy and use it where and when you want to. Minnesota has a strong cluster of fuel cell components manufacturers, companies like 3M and Donaldson and Integrus. But I think it's likely, and our members believe this to be true, that Minnesota's comparative advantage probably lies in producing huge amounts of hydrogen from all of our renewable energy resources, wind and biomass. Indeed, I don't think it's exaggeration to say that if you were to add up the economic potential of renewable hydrogen production from wind and biomass, along with sustainably produced biofuels and electricity, given the aggressive RES that the state has just passed, these three things together could really mean a rural renaissance in this state. Xcel Energy, for example, already has a wind hydrogen project going in Colorado, where they're using wind electricity to harvest the hydrogen from water, storing that hydrogen. So effectively, they've found that by using hydrogen, you chemically store wind power, if you think of it that way, and then using that hydrogen when the wind is not blowing in a gas turbine to produce electricity. And of course, that hydrogen could also be used for vehicles. And wind is not the only option for Minnesota. A 2005 report from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory concluded that if you took just the residual biomass in Minnesota and used the most efficient conversion devices to produce hydrogen, you could displace an enormous amount of Minnesota's gasoline use and electricity. And I think it's important to say that hydrogen doesn't just offer Minnesota yet another clean fuel option. It actually offers a whole new industry, because there's a web of technologies that would be needed to really move aggressively toward the use of hydrogen. Hydrogen needs to be produced, stored, compressed, distributed, and then the end-use technologies. Toro and Xcel are just two small examples. So what does this bill do? It does four things. It officially charges the Department of Commerce with achieving the state's existing statutory goal on hydrogen. You may not have remembered it, but Minnesota has a goal as of 2003, has a statutory hydrogen goal. And as other states devote millions of dollars, and it is millions, to urging their fuel cell and hydrogen industries off the ground, it's critical, our members have felt that it's critical to have a single point of contact and responsibility within the state system. So it gives Commerce squarely this responsibility for achieving the state's hydrogen goal. The second thing the bill does is ask for a $10 million appropriation that would be matched by an equal amount of private investment, so a 50-50 match. And the Department of Commerce would run a competitive grant program using that money to help get off the ground the most commercially promising hydrogen production technologies, homegrown, and end uses for hydrogen and fuel cells. And I guess I would, in your packets, there is a one-page set of examples, and I'm not going to discuss them now, but to read at your leisure, of the kinds of projects, strategically important projects, that such an appropriation could help fund. And I guess I'd like to say that if the appropriation seems high, given all of the other budgetary demands, please consider what this state has invested in its other most promising energy options, wind and biomass, ethanol, biodiesel. I think the request is actually modest compared to the investments the state, the great investments the state has made in those things. Third, the bill requires the state to develop recommendations on uniform codes and standards. And it's we hear it from our industry members in particular that one thing that would really accelerate this industry is if every single town and city didn't have to have the same discussion with the fire marshal about whether or not hydrogen is safe and can you really put a fuel cell in a building. So having uniform codes and standards would really, really help. Fourth and finally, the bill encourages the state to be an early customer of these technologies when that's feasible. And this bill simply adds to a piece of legislation in 2005 by adding the Pollution Control Agency as another advisor to the Department of Administration about when and where it might make sense to deploy hydrogen technologies. Our members believe it's really, really important, particularly given all the activity in other states, that we act boldly now. Everywhere in the world, in fact, where hydrogen and fuel cells are taking off, it's the result of a public-private partnership. Without a clear public commitment and a vision for how hydrogen and fuel cells fit in Minnesota's overall energy system, other states are going to reap the rewards instead and have these industries emerge in their states instead. In fact, as noted by Minnesota's own Department of Employment and Economic Development, quote, during the emerging stage of an industry, development is influenced by technological opportunities created by government intervention in many cases. Minnesota's success in ethanol, biodiesel, and wind offer ample proof of this. I won't belabor this, but I want you to know that in your packet there are a couple of maps. One shows where the Federal Transit Administration recently awarded projects as part of their National Fuel Cell Bus Development Program. And you'll notice from that map that the only projects that got funded are on the coasts, nothing in the vast middle of the country. We were one of the finalists but didn't get awarded. But we'd certainly like to not give up on that and see some of that investment flow here. The second map shows you where existing hydrogen and fuel cell, or hydrogen, rather, hydrogen refueling stations are in North America and the ones that are planned. I think taken together, those maps speak volumes about where capital is flowing today. It's flowing to those states that have a clear vision and a commitment to this important emerging industry. I don't think it's exaggeration to say that the combination of sustainably produced biofuels, electricity, and hydrogen could address three of our most pressing problems in this century: oil dependence, air pollution, and climate change. If you think just of the peace dividend alone, and I don't mean this at all as a political comment, but just the peace dividend from moving toward hydrogen, unlike coal and oil and natural gas, which are unevenly distributed around the world, there's no nation or state on earth that couldn't produce its own hydrogen because it can be made from so many things and in so many ways. So on behalf of the members of the Upper Midwest Hydrogen Initiative, I urge you to pass House File 1392 and make real progress on Minnesota's existing statutory hydrogen goal. I thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Nordstrom, I know we do have a couple of questions here, so before we move on to the next testimony, we'll entertain several of those and then, again, take the next testifier. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see the $10 million is not specifically divided between the roadmap and making grants. And I would be curious, I suppose, about how that's going to be divided, because I wouldn't want to see us having a roadmap with no vehicles allowed to go on it. So that's just one issue. But the second one I'm looking at, and where we have opportunities in Minnesota, I look at the hydrogen-powered airport vehicles, and you've highlighted increased impact by hydrogen shuttle buses between the airport and Mall of America. I think your bigger opportunity is in the extremely polluting vehicles that are now on our airport, moving luggage, et cetera. And if you would look at an air quality map of that region and focus in on the airport, the air quality is terrible, and PCA has those maps. And it's not like Colorado where the airport is way, way out. Our airport is wholly surrounded by communities. And so we have a huge opportunity. The others are more fuzzy and fuzzy, okay? This one could be real, and I would like to see if we're going to do this, have a real goal and get really something done. $10 million is a lot of money. In the airport, Northwest expects huge improvements in its profits, and I think it's time we have better air in the metropolitan area.
Mr. Chair, Representative
McKinney. Mr. Nordstrom, do you want to comment?
Please. Quickly on the division of the money, it's true that the legislation is silent on exactly how that money should be divided. It was left to the discretion of the Department of Commerce to decide how much to spend on developing this roadmap. But your point's very well taken. I think our members certainly don't feel strongly about there not being some division. So if members wanted to, obviously that's certainly your prerogative to pick some certain amount and devote that to the roadmap, leaving the balance for this competitive process. And as for the sheet of examples I handed around, that's by no means meant to be either the set of projects that should be pursued or a comprehensive list. It was just meant to give you a flavor of the kind of thing that could be done. And Representative Guineas, your point about the airport is very well taken. I mean, many of the projects, in fact, that have been done around the world have been done at airports, particularly in the United States, because airports are often non-attainment areas for air quality under the Clean Air Act. So I think there's an enormous opportunity there. I think part of the reason that got written up as it did is there's also a real interest on our members' part in having whatever project is done, at least these initial things, be highly publicly visible. But anything done at an airport, I think, would have that opportunity. You could have a kiosk in the airport that educates people about this technology. You'd certainly get no quibble on our end about doing something like that at the airport. And in terms of the sort of vagueness of the appropriation language in the bill, I mean, it's purposely left vague so that we didn't box ourselves into choosing technologies. We really wanted the Department of Commerce to be able to run a competitive grant process and program where they'd issue an RFP and they would get very specific proposals back from project teams and be able to weigh those and figure out which ones took best advantage of Minnesota's strengths.
Follow-up, Representative Guineas?
Yes, but why don't we look at Minnesota's problems and not just where we know we have problems and say, here's a place that has problems, and we're going to use this for some problem-solving at a place that has problems instead of having competitive grants for things that may not be so problematic. And I just invite you to look at EPA's air quality maps of the airport and to check the pollution control agency's actual air monitoring.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nordstrom, back in 2003 and 2004, I know we had a gentleman, I think his name was Ross, if I'm not mistaken, from the U of M, that there was a gentleman I remember in room 10 right where we were, and we sat and listened to a fascinating presentation about some groundwork research they'd been doing. And part of the reauthorization for Prairie Island, of course, we put some money into that research that I think was happening right here on the Twin City campus. But also, didn't we do a wind-to-hydrogen project out in Morris? All that to ask you this. How's it going? And maybe for Chair Hilty, I think that'd be a fascinating update here once we get past deadlines and are looking for things to talk about. I'd like to know how the ratepayers' money is doing, what they're finding out, particularly the amount of horsepower it takes to actually separate hydrogen from oxygen, because I know they have a real affinity for each other, and it takes horsepower to make that happen. But can you speak briefly to that? And then I do have one follow-up question, Mr.
Nordstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, it's a great question. The Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, I think, is the the entity within the university that you're thinking of that got some investment. Mm-hmm. And I expect that if they haven't already, they'll be reporting back to you on exactly all the variety, the wide variety of research that they funded. A portion of that money was devoted to hydrogen research, and they have come up with some wonderful things. And in fact, part of our members' interest in coming to the legislature this year is that there have been two potentially very low-cost hydrogen production technologies developed at the University of Minnesota. Professor Lanny Schmidt and colleagues, one that reforms hydrogen from ethanol and another that uses, I believe, soybean oil. But we'd like to take that to the next step. Neither of those technologies, to my knowledge, has been scaled up and tested to see if it really has commercial potential. And that's what we would like to see happen, you know, with a portion of this appropriation, is to take it to the next step with private investment and see if this really is ready for prime time. Very quickly, at the University of Minnesota campus near Morris, they obviously have the wind turbine up. They hope to take delivery of their electrolyzer, which is the piece of machinery you need to separate water into its constituent parts. I think they hope to take delivery in the fall. And soon after that, scale up not just a wind-to-hydrogen system that could produce hydrogen, but as members may recall, they want to see if it's feasible to produce anhydrous ammonia fertilizer with that same system. And that may not seem like a big deal at first blush, but at the moment, this country faces a real irony, which is that we're moving toward corn ethanol, which requires a lot of fertilizer inputs, to wean ourselves from foreign oil. But because of high natural gas prices, which make up 90% of the cost of ammonia fertilizer, we now have to import 50% of the fertilizer to grow the corn to make ourselves less dependent on foreign oil. So I think the great insight that the university had was, what if at Morris they can prove that you can take a renewable resource that Minnesota has in abundance, wind, harvest the hydrogen from water, mm-hmm. combine it with nitrogen from the ambient air, and the air is 78% nitrogen anyway, and now you've got the ingredients for anhydrous ammonia. So overnight, and that would represent just meeting Minnesota's ammonia needs, would represent 2 gigawatts of nameplate wind electricity. So a huge boon to the wind sector, and would make Minnesota overnight the renewable hydrogen production capital of the world, because we'd be producing so much hydrogen, partly to make ammonia and partly as a fuel. So I think they're moving along. I can't give you chapter and verse on all of the research that IRE has funded, but I think having them present to you at some other time is a great idea.
Representative Beard, follow up.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Yeah, thanks for that update. And since you mentioned natural gas, that wasn't my next question, but some of us have real concerns about natural gas supply and whether it's going to be sustainable. I know some of the fuel technology demonstration projects that we had a ribbon cutting on here a year or two ago out at Integrys involved natural gas powered fuel cells, which seems to me to be heading in the wrong direction, but maybe it teaches us raw science we need to know to make the other stuff work. My second question had to do with the standards that we're talking about putting together, which we talked about then too, and I know that hydrogen is the smallest molecule and it's going to be kind of tricky to pipe it, jug it, tank it, haul it around. We're looking at Commerce or someone here to develop these standards for handling. I know fire standards are one of them and disposal, things like that. But do we work on a national scale with that? Are we thinking about doing it locally and leading the pack, or are we going to be reinventing the wheel that Underwriters Laboratories or the Society for Automotive Engineering, I know they develop standards that all of industry works with in kind of a nonpartisan way. Are we
right?
You looking at collaborating there, or are we going to blaze the trail here?
Mr. Nordstrom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, it's a great question. I want to be clear, and I apologize if the language in the law is not, or in the bill is not perfectly clear on this. We're actually not proposing that Minnesota develop new standards. We're simply proposing that the state come up with recommendations for you all about how the state should systematically adopt uniform codes and standards that are already developed, many of which have already been developed and adopted by just the standard-making bodies you're referring to. So we're really talking about a process for in a systematic, coherent way, having the state adopt standards once they're developed, not us developing them ourselves here locally. Because as you point out, that work is well underway. There are a few standards that still need to be put in place, but, I mean, we couldn't have as many refueling stations as we have around the world and cars out on the streets if there weren't quite a lot of that work already in place.
Very good. We'll take two more members' questions here before we move on to the next testifier. Representative Gunther.
Thank you. Some of my questions have been answered, but I have one question for the testifier. Is hydrogen fuel cells being developed in any commercial way in the Midwest at all right now, or are we still experimental all over?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, we don't have anybody in Minnesota or in the region we serve, which includes the Dakotas, Iowa, Wisconsin, that's making fuel cells per se, but we have a lot of companies that are making components that go in them. 3M has had a fuel cell components business since the mid-90s, Entegris down in Chaska, Donaldson, ICM Plastics. We have quite a cluster of fuel cell components manufacturers in Minnesota, but the fuel cell industry more broadly outside of the Midwest is by no means experimental. I mean, there are, you know, just at wastewater treatment plants, there are high-temperature fuel cells that are installed, probably 200 of them, out on the East Coast that can use the methane that comes off wastewater treatment plants. In fact, just north of the Twin Cities here, there's a Dennis Hobenshield, which some members might be familiar with, a dairy farmer. He's got one fuel cell and wants more on his dairy farm, which uses the methane that comes off the manure from his dairy cattle. So that's why I said earlier, I'm not sure that our strength in this state and in this region is fuel cells, not the full fuel cell. I mean, I think it's late in the game for us to be trying to get into that industry. There are a lot of others that have fuel cell companies already manufacturing. We have a lot of fuel cell components makers here and a huge potential to produce hydrogen. And the fuel cell is not worth much if we don't have the fuel.
Thank you, Representative Gunther.
It is a very exciting concept, and you really start dreaming what could lead to. I remember Dr. Dean Eldy talking about having hydrogen fuel cells act as distributive generation for whole buildings. And we're looking forward to having those things happen. But I just wondered, in your opinion, is that going to happen and when?
Mr. Narsha?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I mean, I would say in a modest way it's already happening. In fact, in a couple of weeks I'm off to the National Hydrogen Association Conference in San Antonio. And the theme for the conference this year is hydrogen here and now, because there are a lot of applications where it really is ready. And there are fuel cells. There are thousands of fuel cells in buildings right now. There's one powering a skyscraper in Times Square. They're in hospitals and banks. I mean, I think members shouldn't go away. It's not, you know, it's not as common as the internal combustion engine, but it's also not, this is not a science experiment anymore.
Representative Kalin.
I'll pass. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wagenius, one last question here.
Yes, thank you. You mentioned that some East Coast states were using fuel cells for their wastewater treatment plants. We're in dire need of a lot more wastewater treatment plants in Minnesota. Have you worked with the Pollution Control Agency to incorporate some of those ideas with our rulemaking and with our standards that we're putting out?
Mr. Narsha?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, it's a great idea, and the short answer is not yet, but I think it's not because the Pollution Control Agency doesn't have interest. You know, we're a nonprofit organization, very small. We have 6 people, and we serve a very large region, and even though we have a lot of members, you know, I only spend about 25 or 30% of my time on the hydrogen and fuel cell program. So we're sort of, you know, launching this industry on a shoestring, if you will. I see no barrier to working with the Pollution Control Agency on doing that very thing. And, you know, there's no reason why that methane is being produced at these wastewater treatment plants and at landfills, for that matter, anyway. So why not tap that as an energy source and use it in fuel cells? I think it's a great idea.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Nordstrom. Mr. Olson, thank you for your patience. If you would move up to the microphone, identify yourself for your record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Bob Olson. I'm chairman owner of St. Stephen Bank in St. Cloud. I'm a tax business lawyer down in Minneapolis. And by background, I'm one of the founders, chairman of the American Sustainable Energy Council that's been working for 3.5 years in Minnesota to promote sustainable energy, primarily wind, also the ethanol, biodiesel, and hydrogen. I think it's very, very important, Mr. Chairman. When it comes to the variability of wind, the solution appears to be hydrogen. Because as over in Reykjavik, where I visited Jan Bjorn Skulsson, is his name, the president of the Icelandic energy company, they are producing hydrogen through electrolysis with an anode and a cathode. You remember this from high school. Where the hydrogen comes off one pole and the oxygen comes off the other. Shell Oil built a filling station for them. They store it in LP tanks, and then the bus drivers come by. They got three hydrogen fuel cell buses that Daimler Chrysler built for them. This was 3 years ago I was over there, and they were 2 years into this program. The 76, 73 passenger buses come by. The drivers put the hose into the side of the bus, just like you would fuel a car. Instead of pushing the clamp, you spin it on, and the hydrogen goes into the bus, and they go silently with no noise whatsoever through the streets of Reykjavik. We are about 10 or 15 years behind other parts of the world in Minnesota. The only real problem I see with this bill is the amount. I think as far as creating investment in Minnesota in hydrogen and keeping money within the state, we spend about $20 billion a year going out of the state on energy. The only problem is this is too small. I think as a banker, when I look at $10 million, it will build 10 unit apartment buildings. It's not a lot of money, but on the other hand, it is a lot of money. But I like the provision in here that says 50% will come from private investment, and I think that actually, as a banker, knowing leverage, I wouldn't be surprised. But what that $10 million produces, $100 million of investment. That $10 million will be the seed money that creates probably a 90%, $90 million of investment. One of our programs with the Sustainable Energy Council is to get three hydrogen fuel cell buses running, just like in Reykjavik, on the Nicollet Mall and in the University of Minnesota Minneapolis fleet. So that the demonstration is there, just like people in Reykjavik stand beside the street and hear their noisy diesel buses come by and then a silent one comes by. People in Minnesota will realize that this is not futuristic science. It's here. It's now. I think Minnesota really does not get involved in national defense, of course, but I think that doing this bill, this type of thing, is really important as far as national defense is concerned. We now, through wind, ethanol, biodiesel, and hydrogen, no longer need oil, gas, and coal. I've said many times, I'm a tax lawyer, I'm a business lawyer, I'm a banker, I've done the numbers. We are no longer dependent upon coal and oil. And these little initiatives, little $10 million here, little $10 million there, will go a huge way in Minnesota to keeping that $20 billion a year that we send out of state here. I could go on for another probably 3-4 hours if you'd like. But it's a
very favorite
subject. Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you for your testimony. Members, do we have any questions? Mr. Olson, Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Olson, thanks for coming and speaking about the bill and energy issues in general and the challenges facing us. I don't think there's any question that this is the challenge of the next decade or two. We have limited resources that we'll be discussing over the next 2 months. How serious of a challenge is this? Is it serious enough that you, as a obviously fiscal conservative banker, penny pincher, believe that?
Thank you.
We might want to. I mean, this committee on Wednesday night heard about my plastic bags that get washed till they disappear. So we won't go there in terms of my fiscal conservatism. But I'm just wondering how you feel about addressing the limited resources and the return on our investment as we look to make our decisions in the next couple months here.
Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I think the rate of return is exponential. I think where we're at in history, to address your first comment, I think we are about 100 years ago, we were getting ourselves off of the horse and buggies. Today, oil, gas, and coal are the horse and buggies of 100 years ago. Whatever we can do to encourage the investment in the new technology will reap huge amounts for Minnesota. Now, if we wait for other states to do it, they'll do it. It's happening. Europe is way ahead of us. Iceland, with a total population of 250,000 people, is way ahead of us. I think I'm addressing your question. I think it is, as a banker, we do not like to spend money. You are correct. But on the other hand, we understand the value of leverage. And we have capital requirements, and we put a little bit more capital in. We get to take in 12 times the deposits and 12 times the, make 12 times the loans. That's leverage. And I think that Minnesota, taking taxpayers' money, and very carefully, putting $10 million, I would suggest at least doubling that, but into this program, the private community will add at least another $10 million, of course. But I think the leverage that results from that, especially because people will recognize Minnesota as a leader, will be tremendous.
One brief follow-up.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To that issue, what was the name of the Icelandic man?
Jan Bjorn Skudelsen. I love that name.
Can you repeat that one more time?
Jan Bjorn Skudelsen.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to either testify for or against the matter before us? Any further questions from members? Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for the author of the bill, if I may.
Certainly.
Representative Hilty, on the line 3.5, page 3, we do a lot of work through the Department of Commerce, and here we're looking at having them contracting with a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization to help develop this roadmap, or maybe even just to develop it. Who do you have in mind for that?
Chair Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, perhaps we should ask Mr. Nordstrom to answer that question, but I have a feeling it might be the Great Plains Institute.
Mr. Nordstrom, would you like to answer that, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, if I'm looking where you're looking, at line 3.3, it says if the department decides to contract for duties under this section. Okay. So it's entirely up to them whether or not they want to develop the roadmap internally. Mm-hmm. But not to be coy, we, of course, would love the assignment. I mean, if the Great Plains Institute is small, as I mentioned before, mm-hmm. But we have had for now since 2003 this public-private coalition of universities and businesses, and that coalition obviously has a strong interest in how the roadmap comes out. So if We deferred to Commerce on, you know, obviously having that be a choice, but and we're not the only nonpartisan nonprofit organization in the state, so it doesn't necessitate that it's the Great Plains Institute. But I won't be coy. We would love the assignment.
All right, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative or Chair Hilt, any final comments to the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. This obviously is a work in progress, and as I said, we'd like to lay it over for possible inclusion later. It's obvious to me now that it would have been good to have Mr. Olson with us this morning when we discussed our division targets with the chair of the Ways and Means Committee.
Well, the chair renews his motion to lay over House File 1392 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Representative Knuth, are we ready to go?
Yes.
House File 1214, Representative Knuth.
I'd like to move House File 1214 for possible inclusion in the omnibus energy bill. And I have a delete all amendment, which should be in front of members. Amendment H1214DE1. If I could, would you like me to move that and vote on that and then speak to the...
Well, since it is a delete all, Representative Knuth, I think what we should do is just move adoption of the amendment and then we'll discuss.
Okay, and there's one quick correction on the amendment. Basically, just so everything makes sense, on line 2.30, change the word commission to initiative to refer to the initiative on renewable energy and the environment. Referring to the commission doesn't make sense in the framework of the rest of the amendment.
You can just incorporate that in your amendment.
Okay.
Have that, Mr. Elon.
I'd like to move adoption of the H1214DE1 amendment.
Thank you. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Now to your bill.
To Michael's amendment. Basically what this bill does in a general sense is promote the development of community and rural wind development, and it's something we've talked a lot about in this committee and something when we were debating the renewable energy standard that came up again and again. And what we're trying to do with this bill is lower barriers to communities developing wind in their communities in a more grassroots way. And the two tools, the amendment, the delete all amendment, adds another tool more explicitly. And so we've got two tools that communities can use. The first is creating a revolving loan fund that would be administered through the Department of Commerce and would basically come in at a time when it's most difficult for community groups to find and obtain financing for their wind project. So it's kind of a patchwork to get it started and to move it to a phase where it can where they can better more easily obtain private financing, and then it would be returned to the fund to kind of promote projects moving forward. The other tool we have, which is in section 2 of the bill, is a renewable wind energy development program, and this is basically providing for a grant to develop a program that would provide business development assistance, technical assistance, providing a lot of the knowledge and background and tools that community groups would need to develop these projects on their own. And listening to conversation about CBED and about various community groups trying to do some of these projects, a lot of that institutional knowledge, that capacity building, it still needs to go on, and this is a way that we in the legislature can promote that. And then there's an appropriation of a $1 million each year, for the next 2 years to go to each of these tools, the revolving loan fund and the rural wind energy development program. And you know, we've had a few groups coming in to talk about this bill the last few days, and I think just in closing I want to say it's pretty much agreed upon that this is something we need to be looking at, removing those barriers, providing those tools, really giving people the resources they need to create community wind in their own communities. There's some disagreement about some of the details, and you know, we'll keep working on that, but I just want to finish by talking about the strong agreement that this is an important initiative in terms of making sure we develop wind in the way we've talked about and throughout much of these debates and really develop our rural communities around the state.
And Representative Knuth, you have someone to testify?
I do. Mr. John Gavastovich. I also have a representative from Windustry who's not on the agenda, but would also like to speak quickly.
I hate to hurry testimony, but we do have one other bill, and so hopefully we can make this kind of.
I can be real fast.
Mr. Gostovich, thank you.
I'm a consultant independent. We work for Fresh Energy. And I don't see any familiar faces at the table, but I spent a long time sitting where Bob Eloff is sitting today, and it's a delight to be back before this body. With the passage of the Renewable Energy Standard legislation, the legislature essentially turned the energy future of this state upside down fairly dramatically. And with the cooperation of the good faith of all the parties involved to make this renewable energy future work, I'm confident that the state is going to be successful and will be a model for other states in the upper Midwest. One of the outcomes of that bill is that there's going to be $10 billion invested primarily in rural wind energy projects in the next 13 years in the state of Minnesota. That's a tremendous financial aggregate. And the question that this legislation is addressing, and I think addressing very well, is the question, to what extent will rural communities benefit from this investment? If community wind versus large-scale wind development can capture 25% of this investment between today and 2020, that's $2.5 billion for towns, for counties, for farmers, for entrepreneurs, for school districts, for hospitals. And this is a tremendous opportunity. The rural wind development project is not designed to be another state-funded office providing technical assistance. Couldn't be any more different than that. This is a business management and development company. It will become self-supporting based on the value of the services it provides to this industry by charging a small royalty on the sales of successful projects, the wind sales. And there are a number of things that can provide community wind which have a great deal of value and which will increase community wind's attractiveness in the marketplace, because this is a marketplace. The development project that Representative Knuth has introduced will do these things. It'll organize partnerships in rural communities where there is some interest in wind development to put together the businesses and the structures that can go forward with the project. It'll perform a preliminary financial analysis just to see, using reasonable estimates, whether or not this project makes sense. Because not only is it important that good projects go forward, but it's important that bad projects either be fixed or abandoned, because there's too much money here to handle lots of failure. It'll help provide the expertise to do the wind assessments. It will secure a reliable supply of wind turbines for manufacturers. Right now, this is very, very difficult to do, to simply get the turbines if you're a small developer. It will help the community raise both the debt and the equity necessary to essentially build out the capital investment, and it will concentrate to the extent possible on local sources of debt and equity rather than going to the larger capital markets. It'll help the communities negotiate complex legal and business contracts. These are things that most ordinary people have absolutely no experience with, and that should not come as a surprise to anybody. There's a question of putting together ownership structures, royalty structures, negotiating a fair power purchase agreement with the utility. And one of the biggest things it can do is project aggregation. Instead of a community with a 10-megawatt project coming to Northern States Power Company to put together a business relationship, Representative Knuth's program will create an institution which can aggregate projects. So instead of bringing a 10-megawatt project to market, we'll be able to bring a 60, 80, 100-megawatt community wind-scale project to market. This will be providing a great service to the financial markets, to the legal industry, to the purchasing utilities, whether it's Northern States Power Company, Minnesota Power, Great River Energy, whoever it might be. And if we can provide these services, I think we'll go a long way to making community-scale wind a full participant at the table over the next 13 years as we build out this huge investment. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Gasevich. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gascovich, it's a very interesting proposal you're making. You say that the community-based wind projects will be owned by the community people in the community. Is that correct?
To the extent possible. You have to have debt and equity, and to the extent that can be raised locally, that would be encouraged. The same way with our burgeoning ethanol industry. People come into relatively small Minnesota communities and in 4 days raise $40 million. So the capacity is there if the deals are profitable, if the risk has been managed, and if everything makes sense for all the players.
Representative Gunther.
If Mr. Gascovich, sorry about that.
Don't worry.
Typically, a 100-megawatt wind farm is going to cost $150 million. Is that close?
Yeah.
And you think there's that kind of money in a small community to underwrite such a thing? And how do you plan on getting windmills bargained and available for a single project like that? There's a waiting list of about 3 years, I hear.
There is, but the industry is ramping up construction because it's in their economic business to flood the world with these things, given the demand.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons why turbines are as expensive as they are today. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the protocol. I don't think that there's $150 million in the pockets of the folks in a community of 1,100 people or in the local bank. But I think if you have 10, 12 megawatt projects, which are dispersed through a number of communities, all of which can be aggregated to bring a single deal to market, then we're talking about significant quantities of available debt and equity, as well as risk sharing. And while all the capital and all the debt may not be able to be raised locally, I think with this kind of assistance and this kind of expertise, a bunch of it can be. And that would be the goal.
One more question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
It's my understanding that there's a 1.8% investment tax credit for the person buying the windmills. It usually takes somebody pretty big to use that amount of tax credit. I know a community the size of Fairmont probably couldn't use the whole thing. That's 11,000 people.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the tax credit is, I think it's gone all the way up now to 2 cents a kilowatt hour, which is a very, very substantial payment. This is federal legislation. You can only qualify to get the tax credit if you have passive income against which to take it. And people like us, unless we own a lot of rental property, will never have passive income. Our stocks, our bonds, our pension funds, money that we never really have a lot of control over. That is not passive income. Dividends aren't passive income. And this is the reason why in a number of wind deals, the equity partner is a limited partnership, either a non-regulated subsidiary of an electric utility like Southern California Edison or Florida Power and Light, or an investment bank, or a consortium of investors which have an appetite for that tax credit. And what that means in a nutshell is that to some degree that kind of equity will probably be a part of the financing for a lot of projects. And that's just the way the world works. Would that we could take advantage of that.
Thank you.
Members, Representative Magnus, I'd like to get to Ms. Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would too. Is anyone here from RE, the Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment at the U of M, to talk about this? One of my questions, Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative Knuth, is why is ARI basically passing through this money?
Representative Knuth.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
the
Gostovich.
Designated recipient of the funds, who would then evaluate a bunch of proposals and look at both the business plan, the cost, the 35% match, the credibility of the organization, all this kind of stuff. So it would be very competitive. It was chosen, and it's in this legislation for a couple of reasons. One, this is the way that Senator Anderson put the legislation together. This is identical to the language, which is moving fairly non-controversially through the Senate. And so one of the sort of like most practical reasons is to have this bill the same as the Senate bill. The other reason is that it was thought that there were some arguments in favor of having the grant-making institution not be part of the state government bureaucracy, that there would be some advantages to having it be independent from those institutions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand it's a grant to a nonprofit organization. I can guess who those are today from the testifiers. I believe Fresh Energy and Wind Industry, are they not-for-profit organizations or not?
Yes, they are.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Knuth.
Before we get into this conversation, and I think this is one of the places in the bill that will have the most conversation as we move forward and possibly consider this in the omnibus bill, we have a testifier here from Windustry who I think has some concerns with our Fresh Energy testifiers, but also probably some general comments as well. If we could have her speak, or would you like
to go ahead with that, Representative Magnus? Sure. Ms. McAbee.
Mr. Chair, and I hope our testimony will provide some light. I'm Paula McAbee, and I'm a consultant for Windustry. And I think one of the most important things to realize is that community energy, without being consolidated to look more like corporate wind, has been very successful in Minnesota so far. Approximately 26% of the wind that's in the ground in Minnesota is community-based, community-owned wind. And yes, that sometimes requires an equity partner of a large enough scale to be able to take advantage of the passive investment benefits. What's important about this is that the market's changing. I mean, there's a recent conference, the Wind Power Finance and Investment Summit in California this February, talking about how there's an effort to consolidate in the industry. The small businesses, developers, are being consolidated into middle size are being eaten up by large corporations, and they're large corporations that are now buying up wind rights without necessarily an imminent plan to develop them. So one of the things that Windustry is trying to do is to make sure that smaller independents, whether it's counties, schools, or collective organizations of farmers and landowners, have an opportunity to benefit and return the economic strength of the investment in wind to the community.
Ms. McAbee, let me interrupt you just a second. We do have House File 1624 on the agenda. We're hoping to take testimony. It's Representative Hausman's bill. She's not able to be here today, but we did want to open the discussion on that. And Mr. Pomeroy is currently seeing if we can maintain our presence in this room in order to do that, or possibly move to another room. So I just want to tell the people that are here for that reason that we have not yet abandoned the possibility of hearing that bill today. So sorry for the interruption, Ms. McAbee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try and be brief. We proposed the idea of having a revolving fund in the Department of Commerce to specifically address two problems that small wind developers have, which is the need to do wind studies for the quality of wind in the area and transmission studies to determine what will be required in order to connect their projects to the federal system. And these are kinds of loans that cannot be collateralized. They're pre-development expenses. So having a revolving loan fund allows developers, small developers, local developers, to take advantage of resources that might not be available to a bank. We are very strongly in support of Representative Knuth's idea of getting some kind of technical help to smaller community projects. We're not as comfortable with the idea that our objective is to develop a business plan, as it seems that Mr. Gosrich was explaining, that some nonprofit would then bring out to the community and try and form all the community wind projects into a unified entity. That sounds very top-down to us from our perspective as Windustry. It doesn't seem that the language of the legislation is intended to do that, but if that vision is what's driving it, we'd like to say that our view is much more to be responsive to the needs of actual community wind developers. Windustry gets about 1,500 hits on our website a day, and that's increasing. Sometimes people looking at 8 to 10 pages of documents, which include sort of basic information on walking through how do you evaluate your project. And our sense is that this ought to be a competitive process. We're not sure whether IRE is the appropriate location and willing to continue discussion on that. But to make sure that this is going to be a service that actually helps community wind and doesn't impose from above or from the metro area a system and say this is the way community wind needs to be done. So we're very interested in this moving forward, and we're interested in working with the chair and with Representative Knuth on how to make sure that this is actually a project that's responsive to the needs of community wind. Was that quick enough?
Yes, thank you.
I still have questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Magnus. And Mr. Peterson, if you want to testify, come on down and we'll work you in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my initial questions were about why is IRE in Minnesota doing the pass-through here? It looks like it's kind of a I don't understand it. I'm a big supporter of IRE, and several of us at the table are. They're basically a research entity and coordinating research in this, and I don't understand why they're acting as the pass-through. I wish they were here to testify. I'm confused a bit about this nonprofit organizations here, and Mr. Chairman, just to cut to the chase, we have had several of these organizations come and lobby heavily for the renewable energy standards pushed and other initiatives here, and only to see them come back here now, Mr. Chairman, and try to get more funding from the state, and it looks like in a roundabout way. I don't know if they're worried about somebody. Us folks out there not being smart enough to figure out the trail of money here or what. And I don't know the list of nonprofit organizations that have experience in this. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, our experience in Southwest Minnesota, we've got significant experience in wind and been doing it for a long, long time. I do recognize we do have some problems in certain areas, but it's disturbing to me, Mr. Chairman, to see groups come in here and lobby for changes to an energy plan and then come back and lobby for money to pull it off. And I've said that from day one, Mr. Chair. I voiced my concerns about doing a comprehensive plan because I was worried about this sort of thing, not getting a plan together that would work, that was reasonable, and then having the so-called nonprofit organizations get their head in the hog trough here.
Well, Representative Magnus, that's exactly where we're hearing
that's
this bill now. And
that's the way we go.
Thank you for raising those questions. I'm sure the author will attempt to address them at some point, possibly not this afternoon. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'll be very brief. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. Usually we're always not sure about a metro area person carrying a rural development assistance program, but in this case, I'm here today to say that I see a need for this bill, and I'm not sure about the nonprofits or who's getting the money. This bill says the nonprofits. We're comfortable with that, but what I've noticed is since we passed the RES and even into this summer, that we've started to get calls from our members that are putting together projects, and they're starting to say, you know, we're going to do this. Who do we call? You know, who do I send them to? I send them to Department of Commerce, Mike Bull. I send them to Windustry. We call AURI. There's all kinds of people that provide different things, but it's difficult a lot of times to know where to get going. And I worry about, you know, where they're going to go, and because some of the projects I bet are very good, and trying to figure that out. But I am here to tell you that I see the need there, you know, because many of our members are getting involved, obviously, in CBED, individual projects, LLCs, co-ops, the school-type projects that we see in many of your districts. And, again, who do we send them to? Who do we call? Who's the central location? I just think that this would be very helpful, however we work this out. But I think there's a strong need for that, and I just urge your consideration, again, because I do get the calls. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Further questions at this time, Representative Gunther?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Peterson, could I ask you what the... almost got out of here.
Almost got away, Mr. Peterson.
Do you think it would be appropriate, you know, from the standpoint of people in greater Minnesota, and I appreciate your statements very much, that we have this entity that is going to take this money over, state money, tax money, report to the legislature the first of the year or thereabouts what the progress of that they have made in dealing with this money and what they have accomplished with the money. And I can see what you're saying. It makes a lot of sense to me, but just to be on the safe side, don't you think we should have a little accountability?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gunther, absolutely. I think that's a great idea. And I just thought of two other quick things. I was trying to get out of here in a hurry. But, you know, sometimes something like this might help some projects not get built. And I say that with kind of, you know, it's kind of a different deal. But, you know, some of the calls I've gotten, too, are ones that, you know, I don't want to see people invest. We're talking about $150 million a project. And There are people talking about trying to raise not that kind of money, but significant amounts of money, and I worry about that it might not be the right situation. So a lot of times when they get into the early planning stages, they might decide this isn't the place to do it. So that's helpful. I also want to point out for the members' information that we also, as a farm organization, are working with Farmers Legal Action Group here in St. Paul to develop what's called a Farmer's Guide to Wind, Farmer's Guide to Wind, that'll address what a farmer needs to know about wind, and they'll have that publication done in May. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gunther.
I would very much like Mr. Eliff, if it's all right with you, to draft a section. Would be in at the end of the bill to ask for this entity to report to the legislature what they have done and what they've accomplished, because I think it's got a lot of merit. And I think I'd like to know what's being done here. And I totally agree with Mr. Peterson's summation that there are a lot of people who don't know where to go, and I would like a safe place for them to go. And I'd like to see the results of this.
Thank you. And, of course, we will be discussing this bill further as we get into the finance bill.
Mr. Chair, at the end of the bill, basically 2.28, 2.33, the initiative shall use best practices regarding grant management functions, selection monitoring of the grantee, compliance review, financial oversight. I'm not sure if I want to vote on an amendment today, having, you know, not thought about it in terms of a review. I mean, I do want this to have oversight, you know, having worked in the nonprofit world and gotten state grants, working on state grants myself, I appreciate the importance of that. So I would like to work with you on that. I'm just not sure if we're ready to vote.
Representative Knuth, I don't think Representative Gunther was offering an amendment today.
I wasn't today.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I think we can have plenty of time to do it in the future.
Okay. Further discussion of this bill at this time, Representative Peterson? Pass.
Very well. We will lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Knuth. Members, Mr. Pomeroy informs me that we do have a little more time that we can occupy the room, so if we could take up briefly at least the opening salvos in the in the discussion of House File 1624. Representative Johnson, if you're presenting the bill for Representative Hausman. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll invite my testifiers up as move the bill over. I think that's the chair's intent to lay over, and I would.
It is our intent. Representative Hausman was not able to be here today. She did ask that we take additional testimony on the bill and that it be laid over until she's able to attend and to continue with the consideration of the bill. So with that, we can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the patience of the committee and the chair in particular as we spend a few moments talking about this bill. I'm just going to make a few introductory comments and then turn over to my testifiers for their further thoughts on the matter. House File 1624. What this bill will do will allow the Rock 10 Company plant in St. Paul's Midway area to transition from fossil fuel energy to a renewable energy source. This plant, operating since 1908, recycles 50% of all the paper recycled in Minnesota, about 1,000 tons per day, and has almost 500 employees. For over 20 years, Xcel's coal-fired hybrid power plant has provided steam to Rock 10 via a 5.5-mile pipeline, which you might have seen running down towards 94 there, which supplanted Rock 10's old oil and natural gas boilers. However, this summer, the coal-fired hybrid power plant is set to close as part of the Metropolitan Emissions Reductions Project and replaced with the peaking natural gas plant. And this means Rock 10 will no longer have a source of steam for its energy-intensive recycling operations. This loss of reliable energy was the most costly consequence for any energy consumer in the metropolitan area as MRP goes into effect. The MRP renewable transition charge, as noted in the bill, will help in the transition to a renewable energy source from Rock 10 or for Rock 10. It would impact rates by 0.1% and be billed as part of Xcel's current MRP charges. Now, funds received under this charge would be used only for a new energy center using renewable fuels to produce the energy needed by Rock 10. The amount of cost that would be recovered would be determined by the PUC, and the St. Paul Port Authority would serve as financing agent. I have with me, Mr. Chair, Lori Lauder from the Port Authority, and she's going to make a few comments as well.
Ms. Lauder, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon to committee members. My name is Lori Lauder. I'm the Director of Development for the St. Paul Port Authority. I'd like to say a few quick words, and in the interest of time, I'm going to go through rather quickly. I'd like to get to my customer here, Jack Greenshields, who's the Senior Vice President and Local Plant Manager for Rock 10, and there are others who wish to testify as well. As you know, the Port Authority is an economic development agency, and one of our main lines of business is to be sure that we are causing the creation and retention of good jobs at good wages in St. Paul and East Metro. And this is a key issue here before you. Wanted to mention a couple of things that Representative Johnson mentioned, and I think they bear repeating. Rock 10 is a huge economic force here in Minnesota. They not only provide 50% of all paper recycling in Minnesota, but it also provides fully 1% of the nation's paper recycling. Recycles 1,000 tons a day of paper products, provides 500 jobs, and I might add that this company is controlled by the corporate officers in Norcross, Georgia. And about 4 years ago, they pulled the plug on over 400 jobs in the carton folding plant. So we have 500 jobs remaining that we need to save. These jobs have great average annual wage at $60,000 on average. Total payroll per year, Mr. Chairman, is $28 million. In addition to that, Rock 10 purchases $25 million a year of scrap products, and in addition to that, spends over $75 million per year on local goods and services in Minnesota. So it's at risk for leaving Minnesota, and we need to do something about it, we believe. Rock 10, as Representative Johnson mentioned, has been tied into the MERP situation. Rock 10 actually is comprising 30% of Xcel's operations at the Highbridge plant in St. Paul. And yet, this summer, Rock 10 is going to be shut off from that thermal energy source. Rock 10 needs 725 degrees steam heat to operate, and that's going to be shut off. They will immediately supplant that with number six fuel oil and natural gas. The air emissions from that operation are not going to be terrific. Mr. Chairman, on to the bill. This is a huge business retention issue, as you can see, but we at the Port Authority and with our partners have decided to move forward aggressively to attempt to retain this company here in the following ways. We would hope to finance, construct, and own a new biomass thermal energy center facility. This would be constructed on a portion of Rock 10's campus. As most of you may know, Rock 10 is located at I-94 and Vandalia on about 42 acres. We would take 8 to 10 acres within that campus and construct this new biomass facility. And we need your help to do that. Mr. Chairman, this bill provides a request for $20 million. This is part of the total project cost of about $200 million, round figures subject to tweaking and change. This $200 million breaks out into generally about $150 or $160 million we think that we can raise from investors through the sale of tax-exempt bonds by the Port Authority, which is an issuer of such debt. But in addition to that, we have sunk cost needs. We have the equity portion. And we do respectfully ask that you give us the ability to obtain $20 million as part of this equity amount. In closing, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for your attention to this important economic development and job retention issue. I wanted to also mention that we have achieved supporting resolutions from the Resource Recovery Board, which is Ramsey County and Washington County, the City of St. Paul, all unanimous resolutions, as well as a unanimous resolution recently from the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners. And I wanted to recognize that Victoria Reinhardt is here today as one of the Ramsey County Board members. Thank you very much. I'd like to introduce Jack Greenshields.
Mr. Greenshields, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and representatives. Thank you very much for the opportunity to offer our testimony today. We also appreciate you lengthening the type of your meeting on a Friday afternoon, so we do appreciate that. I'll make an effort not to duplicate what Director Lauder has already said, but try to restrain my remarks to some new topics. Again, my name is Jack Greenshields. I'm the Senior Vice President and General Manager of the Rock 10 Company facility located here in the midway of St. Paul. Just to reiterate, energy is a significant portion of the manufacturing cost of producing recycled paperboard. And anyone that's in this room is welcome to take a tour of our facility and see how it's done. Our energy is in the form of steam and electricity, and the annual bill exceeds $20 million for a plant our size. The paper industry segments that we participate in are highly competitive with challenges both foreign and domestic, and we have to look at all of our costs, especially our critical cost of energy. We believe that Rock 10's become a truly unintentional victim of good public policy as a result of the legislative initiative leading to the Metropolitan Emission Reduction Plan. Over a $1 billion project for which Xcel will recover costs plus earn an approximate 11.5% return. The recovery and the emissions reductions are entirely appropriate and Minnesotans will benefit from improved air quality and other efficiencies. However, we really strongly believe that part of the MERP system was missed and was not acknowledged. The planners of MERP perhaps unfortunately trivialized a significant impact. Also, in addition to that, our multiple discussions with Xcel, which continue and which have been very appropriate and honest and direct, have not yet resulted in any responsive solutions to our issues. A little bit of history. That shows that in the early 80s, an umbilical cord in the form of a 5.5-mile pipeline was completed to connect the Xcel High Bridge Power Plant to what is now the Rock 10 Recycled Paper Mill to supply steam. It has been a win-win business arrangement for all parties. Economical steam for Rock 10 was provided to us, and someone to share the operating expenses of the High Bridge Power Plant was provided to Xcel. I think all parties would have negotiated a continuation of that arrangement should indeed the High Bridge Power Plant not have been converted to a natural gas facility. Indeed, on the Xcel website, the Xcel Energy High Bridge Units 3 and 4 gas conversion feasibility study back in July of 2001 referred exactly to what needed to be done to convert that part of the facility to natural gas. And their last statement in their project said that the cost to produce a unit of steam using natural gas that would have been provided to Rock 10 on that steam line would have been over 2.5 times higher than it was under the cost of coal. The initial capital cost for the steam line in the early 80s was approximately $40 million plus interest to support that $40 million. Experts that we have talked to believe that the life of the steam line was nearly 50 years. MERP effectively severs the umbilical cord 25 years before the end of its useful life. Closing the coal-fired High Bridge plant will require Rock 10 to rely on its own power plant in the Midway, which uses natural gas and oil as fuel. It is appropriately permitted by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agencies, and we have the necessary Title V air permits from the MPCA and the EPA. When we start operating this power plant continuously, our emissions and costs will increase dramatically. Just as a matter of fact, the level of emissions of PM and PM10 and SO2 will be increased over 40% from the reductions resulting in the closure of the coal-fired High Bridge plant by itself. This was an impact that was unforeseen in the original MERP documents. Rock 10, with the assistance of others, has been researching alternate steam supply approaches that reduce and stabilize costs and also reduce air emissions. Rock 10 would like to be an anchor tenant of a combined heat and power complex owned by the St. Paul Port Authority using renewable fuels and state-of-the-art combustion and emission technologies. The Green Institute in Minneapolis was given the assignment with much state and local input to research biofuels. A preliminary report is now in draft stage. Sponsors of this report include Rock 10, the City of St. Paul, the St. Paul Port Authority, the Ramsey and Washington County Resource Recovery Project Board, the Resource Recovery Technologies Company, and Eureka Recycling. The final report will be available shortly and will become a public document for the benefit of all Minnesotans. Now, if we take a quick look at the bill that Representative Hausman has introduced, it does amend Minnesota Statute 2006, Section 216B.1692, which we understand may be a significant concern for Xcel, which considers, quite honestly, the statute to be private property unto which we're trespassing, and we apologize. However, we have narrowly focused the amendment to avoid setting a broad precedent. And yes, if this project proves viable, and the electrical ratepayers will incur a negligible increase in costs. We believe the $20 million added to the current $1-plus billion for MERP is a small cost to move closer to improved air quality, energy interdependence, and the saving and the development of living wage jobs in Minnesota. We thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Mr. Greenshield. Members, I think this is as far as we'll be able to get with the consideration of this bill today. I wanted to get at least this far so that members who have not yet heard from any of the concerned parties would have some idea of what is at issue here. And I think it's somewhat fair at least to say that what the main point of contention here is not whether anybody wants the facility to continue to operate or this type of energy source to be created, but rather who pays for it, how it's paid for. And also, I think there are some issues that we will hear about concerns about whether it should be built at all. We will be taking this up again when we're able to arrange it with Representative Hausman and with testifiers. For those of you who are here today to testify that we were not able to get to, I apologize. These things happen, and we will try to make sure that we accommodate everyone who wants to testify on this issue as soon as it's possible. And with that, members, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much for your patience.